Okay, the homework average, I believe, was about 36. The TA will be sending a mail with the exact statistics, but he just told me that the average was 36. And the solutions would be posted. Second homework, I will put up at least parts of it by end of today's class, and so that would essentially involve things like, you know, all the search algorithms, A-star search, informed search, and CSP at least. Okay. So this font is kind of messed up, so there's some things are going away, but I want to tell something. Although you probably can't tell from my flawless East Coast accent, I'm actually from India. And when I was growing up in a little town called Peddapuram, before I even knew that there is a country called America, I knew there was some guy called Lincoln, because the local, one of the local elementary schools was called Lincoln School, and this was a government school, okay? So if you are talking, and you know, this was way, way back. I don't want to say how old I am, and you know, the globalization hasn't exactly taken place. And and still this school existed. I didn't quite know why it's called Lincoln School. In fact, we used to call it Lincolnes School, and you know, in our own way. And you know, it took a longer time to figure out who this character was. And you know, there's much more globalization that happened, and I still haven't seen a Clinton School or a Bush School, George Bush School in India. So if you want to transcend, if you're thinking about people who transcend boundaries, who transcend, you know, single countries, this guy is one, okay? And so this is his 200th birthday, as most of you know. And I put these things here, it's very interesting, most of you probably know, but the interesting thing that about Lincoln is his views constantly changed. In a world where a president would not want to change his view, even though, in fact, no WMDs were ever found, this is a fresh difference, you know. So, in fact, his views constantly change, as you can see, from here to here. And I'm sorry, you can't see that, but basically what he said, one of the things he said was he doesn't have any respect for a man who is not any wiser today than he was yesterday, okay? Life is learning, and you are always supposed to become wiser the next day, and you know, and adapt to yourself to what you learn. And see, this business of adaptation brings us to the next guy who also happens to have been born exactly on the same day, 200 years back. You know, two giants who shaped our thinking and you know, political or scientific thinking. That's of course Charles Darwin. And and you know, essentially, he points out that adaptation is really the nub of it all. You know, it's not the most intelligent person who survives, most intelligent species that survives. It's not the strongest species that survives. You know, I don't still see any dinosaurs around. And at the time of extinction of dinosaurs, mammals were like little thingies. You know, and you know, we just happened to survive because we adapted, presumably. So, you know, there's a sort of an interesting day. I mean, this kind of special days come once in a lifetime. And so even though you might think this has nothing to do with the course I'm going to teach, which is Intro to AI, you know, you still have to mention, you know, you cannot ignore the world that's outside of this classroom. And in fact, normally I don't discuss a particular set of hill climbing algorithms called genetic search algorithms, but I thought, in deference to Darwin, I'll make an exception today. And we will, in fact, discuss genetic search algorithms. I don't like them, okay? It's not because I don't think evolution is bogus, which I guess, you know, is a supposedly increasing view now, but it's because genetic algorithms try to mimic evolution, but they don't need to do it, essentially, in terms of computational efficiency. So we'll talk about those, but that's the thing. And I read this quote somewhere. In fact, there's a book that's out. I think there's lots and lots of books, but there's a book that's out which essentially contrasts the influences. I mean, really, there's not too much to contrast because these two are completely different people. One is a politician, one is a scientist, but they change to some extent a lot about how we look at the world. And I really like that sentence because until that time, in fact, you know, people used to think about God and soul as the main point of existence. And so slowly the change went from soul to mind, and because it's about mind, you are in this class, okay, because you want to provide artificial minds to programs. And then from angels to ages, in fact, this is a very interesting point. Most of you know, I think, Edward Stanton's quote when, Lincoln finally died. And he said, now he belongs to the ages. But the reality was, he actually said, now he belongs to the angels. And then it was misheard, and it became, now he belongs to the ages. And that's way more interesting, because in the context of Lincoln, if you read any of his biographies, the big biographies of Lincoln, he's probably one of the most agnostic and probably close to atheistic persons you could find in 19th century. He didn't believe in heaven, he didn't believe in hell. He believed that the only thing that you have is what people think of you after you're gone. And man, did he become lucky on that part, right? I mean, if that's heaven or hell, then, you know, he was a very insecure man who worried about what other people will think of him after he's gone. And if you work towards that, he really, really succeeded, okay? And in fact, that's the point that Darwin basically pointed out, in essence, that evolution taking in the deep recesses of time is much more scientifically plausible explanation of why we are here than, you know, whichever, you know, force that you expect who actually cooked us all up over 6 to 68 days. Okay. Anyway, so that's all. In fact, we will get back to Darwin in today's class in a technical sense, because, as I said, we'll talk about hill climbing search, one kind of hill climbing search called genetic algorithms. Okay. For the exciting technical stuff now, this is basically a short, brief summary of what we were talking about last class, general search versus constraint satisfaction problems, okay? And you should be able to see basically that CSP is a subset of search where the state is made up of state variables. Children generation involves just assigning values to more of the variables that have not been assigned values. State space is finite, unlike normal search, where depth can, the state space can be infinite, not because you have infinite branching factor, because we ignore that, we don't look at that kind of search problems, but because you could have infinite depth, okay? But that's not possible in CSP, because in fact state space is finite, because there are only finite number of variables, and if you assign all of them, you know, the depth of the tree is only n, if n is the number of variables. Okay, and a state is a goal state if all the variables are assigned and no constraints are violated. Okay, and then all goals occur at the same depth. Because all goals occur at the same depth, in the basic formulation, all goals have the same cost. I'm sorry, that's a mistake. All goals appear at the same depth, and all goals also have the same cost, because you don't actually, since all of them are supposed to satisfy all the constraints, there is really no differentiation between one complete consistent assignment and another complete consistent assignment. And since all of them appear at the same depth and all of them have the same cost, there is no reason to consider any search algorithm other than depth first search, because there is no infinite depth, and every, and even at the same end depth, basically the first one that you find is as good as the second one you will find. Okay, so that's why you will always use depth first search. And then, so this is, we talked about it a lot last class. And then the heuristics to improve the depth first search, in essence, you know, depth first search sort of basically is a backtracking search, because it goes all the way, it tries to go all the way to the nth level, you know, giving variables assignments, okay? But once in a while, it tries to give a particular assignment to a variable, it finds that that partial assignment is already dead. One interesting point is, if a partial assignment is dead, there's no point in extending it any further. Once you violate a constraint, you can never make it better again. Okay? So because of which, it then has to go up and try a different value for that same variable. So it is going up and coming down is basically backtracking. Okay? So you normally call depth first search a backtracking search. Okay? And depth first normal backtracking essentially is chronological or naive backtracking, where you just, irrespective of what the failure is, you go just one level up. Okay? And then you can improve the performance of depth-first search significantly. We know that depth-first search normally is uninformed, it doesn't actually think of what else you're going to go. You know, it only knows how far it has come. But you can improve the performance of depth first search by heuristics that are task specific, basically CSP specific, rather than the particular CSP problem specific. Okay, and all you need to do is, we talked about two very smart ideas last class, which are basically pick the most constrained variable next to assign value to, and once you pick that variable, give it the least constraining value. Okay, now both these, you have to ask yourself, why is this about future? Because the way a search algorithm becomes informed is, so you have a current level in any search algorithm. You have a current level, so you started from null assignment, and then you, let's say you say x1 equal to A, then you said x1 equal to A and x2 equal to B, and so on. And let's say you are, and then you also said x1 equal to A and x2 equal to B and x3 equal to C, and this is where you are right now. This is your current level. These are past. Okay, if you assume that the variables are x1 all the way to xn, right, then from here all the way down, so x4 to xn are future variables. You haven't yet seen the future. Okay, so in fact, this is the terminology that people do use. This is future variables, these are past variables, this is the current variable. The current variable here is x3, because you just given a value to it. Okay, the reason these ideas are about future is because they are looking not at what you have done till now. They are looking at what else is left, which are x4 to xn. And then within them, they are trying to analyze which of them have the smallest number of possible values they can take. So they are looking ahead. A search becomes informed by looking ahead. And this is a looking ahead idea. And then again, after having picked, so they don't have to go in any arbitrary order of x1 to xn. They basically, at this point, I will look at the rest of the variables, and I might say, oh, x29 seems to have the smallest domain, so I'm going to branch on it first. Once I decide that x29 is going to be my next variable, then I need to decide which of the values of x29 will I consider. And then you pick the value of x29 that is consistent with the most number of variables. Okay, so that means it does not constrain the values of the rest of the variables. Okay, once again, that too takes into account the future, not the past. Not just the past, but the future too. Okay, you notice that if you are not consistent with the past variables, you would know it anyway, right? Because the search will be killed at that level. If you're not already consistent with the past variables, so for example, I take x29 and give it a value z, but there is a constraint which says if x1 equal to a, then x29 cannot be equal to z. That's a constraint. Then you wouldn't even have generated that possibility because search node would stop it. What you're doing in taking the most least constraining value is also taking into account the future variables. Okay? So by doing that, in essence, you already get quite ahead of normal depth first search. You now can actually solve much larger problems. And these are heuristics. They don't look like the admissibility the path length based heuristics we have learned, but these are heuristics. Are they admissible? Yeah, because admissibility means if you use the heuristic, could you lose completeness? Could you lose optimality? You can't lose completeness because it's a finite depth tree. Okay? And you can't lose optimality because all solutions are equally created. So these heuristics are admissible. You have to ask yourself. You know, they look very different from the A star search heuristics. But the main point about heuristics is you take future into account. And for this class of problems, this is the best way to take the future into account. Okay? In fact, we will do a little more than that even. we will not only do, so until now, when I talked about most constrained variable and least constraining value, all I am talking about at the best is one level above. So the next level, I'm going to pick x29 and try the value z. Okay, now as I'm trying the value z, I can actually look ahead and see if anybody is going to be really mad at me because I'm trying the value z. One interesting question is, suppose I did x, you know, I'm trying the value z here. Turns out that x, one, you know, 10,000 only has the value z in its domain. That's the only thing it can take. And there's a constraint which said that if x29 should not be equal to x10,000. That's a constraint in the problem. Okay? You will find this failure. You will find this failure. You will at some point of time pick this variable, try to give it a value, find that there is no value. And since it's a CSP problem, everybody needs a value. So you'll come all the way up from wherever you are and then redo all the search again. Okay? It would make sense when you make a local decision like this to very quickly compute the effect of that local decision on the future variables. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? And that idea is basically the next idea we'll look at, which is basically called forward checking. As the name implies, you're going to check forward the implications of the decision you are about to take, that you took just now, right? Okay? And the advantage of that is the forward checking may not only allow you to figure this out, which means forward checking actually will say x10,000 would not have a value, so I die right away. And remember that if you're going to die anyway, die fast. Because if a branch is going to eventually die, it's better that it dies earlier. Because if it doesn't die now, then a dying branch will generate exponential number of branches underneath it, which is a subtree below it, all of which will also be dying. Do you understand what I'm saying? If there is a constraint that is violated in this branch, you know, whether you like it or not, then it's going to basically kill this entire subtree. And so if you're going to fail anyway, fail first. That's the fail first heuristic idea, right? So if this was direct failure, well, that this kind of analysis would help. But it could also help in some other ways. For example, let's say x1000 actually has z as well as w in its values. Now that I decided to give x29z, I don't have a failure, but I do know that as far as this branch is concerned, x10,000 really only has one value left. And if then somebody else winds up, you know, you do another decision which also removes the W value, then you did get a failure. So in essence, what you want to do in forward checking essentially is keep track of the effective domains of the variables. There is a normal domain. You know, they say everybody can be anywhere between 1 to 10,000. But then as constraints start, you know, piling up, the number of actual values a variable can take keeps reducing. And it ever becomes empty, you're dead. The moment you realize it, even if you have not picked that variable for expansion, you may as well kill that search branch. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? That is a great idea. It requires a little more work while you're doing search, and that's basically the forward checking idea. And then I'll just show it to you. In essence, I kind of explained to you what's going to happen, but I'm going to show it to you with respect to this example. This is again a coloring example. Okay? So in essence, you will keep track of the live domain of each variable in each branch. Okay? Now, in fact, since it's a depth first search, you really need to keep track of the live variable, one live domain for each variable. Because when you backtrack, its domain changes. You never really have to keep track of multiple domains. Okay, because depth first search is at any time looking at one branch at a time. Okay, so here is a situation where, again, this is a coloring problem, and you know it's a map coloring problem, and we are trying to color them with three colors, RGB, and the usual idea that you cannot color two neighboring countries with the same color. that's a basic idea. No two neighboring regions can have the same color. Okay, so I picked C1. Okay, I picked C1 and I didn't know anything better, so I gave it red. Because there's really nothing. I mean, all variables have the same, you know, the idea of most constrained variable doesn't work because all of them have equal size domains. And similarly, least constraining value doesn't also tell you anything. All the values are equally good. Okay? So you take C1 and give it, let's say, red, just for the, you know, for this particular branch. Then what happens? The moment you put red in C1, then for C2, it cannot be red. Okay, so from the domain of C2, red is removed in essence for this branch. Okay, and similarly for C4 also the red is removed, and similarly for C5 also red is removed. So in this branch right now, the branch which starts with C1 equal to red, three of the variables now only have two size domains. One variable has three size domains. Now tell me, which would be the next variable you would pick? Would you pick, for example, C3 as the next variable? Makes no sense, because always pick the most constrained variable. Most constrained variable. Previously it looked, so the idea of most constrained variable that I mentioned earlier, it was sort of dependent on a static domain size. But now you can actually use it in a much more interesting way. The domain keeps reducing as you keep going forward. And so you can reevaluate and see who has the tightest domain and pick them. Okay, so the idea called dynamic variable ordering idea essentially says pick the most constrained variable after having done the forward checking. Yes, sir. No, so there is a very interesting point. The ideas, actually that's a very good question, the ideas of most constrained. And most constrained and least most constrained variable and least constraining value, these are English phrases. Okay, you can provide multiple formal interpretations for these English phrases. The interpretation I'm giving for most constrained variable is that the domain size is the smallest. The interpretation you are giving is that it has the maximum number of constraints with other variables. Both are good. Okay? Popularly, people try to, when they say most constrained variable, they essentially consider it in terms of the variable size. But there have been cases, in fact, in general, these are meta ideas, and they can actually be interpreted in multiple ways. The standard way of interpreting it is in terms of the domain sizes. Okay, but it is a good point to keep in mind that there are cases where, in fact, you would like to think of most constrained variable in terms of the number of constraints it has with other variables. Okay, so. And then, in fact, if you have multiple interpretations, you can use the second interpretation to break ties, for example. So nothing stops you. Again, from now on, in fact, everything in these classes, you know, since it's an introductory AI class, every lecture I give has an actual one course long extension, maybe multiple courses long extension. Okay, CSP, we are spending 1 week on CSP. You can have an entire one semester or two, you know, 1 year course on CSP, you know, as to how much is actually being done there. Okay, we're again sort of looking at and getting some of the essential ideas. Okay, but it's a very good question. And then we are just going to think of most constrained variable in terms of the domain size. Okay, so now I have go to pick. All I can tell is from in terms of most constrained variable, I'll pick either this or this or this. I should not be picking this. It makes no sense. Okay, let's assume I'll pick C2 this time. If I pick C2, then and I gave it, you know, obviously I can't give it the red. I have to give blue or green. Okay, let's assume I gave it blue. Okay, what would happen there? Once I give it blue, then I can no longer give blue to C5. I can no longer give blue to C3. And I can no longer give blue to C4. right? Now, so this particular table will change if you backtrack, obviously. But this table keeps increasing monotonically by additional entries as you go forward on a particular branch. Okay? So now I do this essentially. In this particular case, the next variable I'm going to pick is what? I have to either pick C4 or C5. Now here is the interesting thing. If in fact, as I am doing this, somebody's domain became empty, which means it's actually a failure, notice that you would pick it first. Because if a variable has zero size domain, that is the most constrained domain. So in fact, the dynamic variable ordering already picks the failing first variable. So you don't have to do anything different to say, is there a failing variable? When you try to pick the most constrained variable next, you may pick one which has zero number of values left, then you say, we're dead, we have to backtrack. And when you backtrack, of course, you need to change this table. You understand, right? Because the last decision you made, it's no longer done. So you remove that and you remove the values that you put in because of that. Okay, so in this particular case, I can do C4 and C5, either of them, and then let's say I pick C4, right? Then, I actually picked C4 and I should write Y here. That Y should be there. That's a mistake, right? So C4, I picked C4 and then I gave it green, so the Y will be here. So green is yes, and then at that point, more or less, you're done. You will pick the next two variables and you'll continue. This is power checking idea. And in writing the code, the interesting thing would be when you backtrack, making sure that you remove all the consequences of the previous decision. Backtracking already takes care of undoing the previous decision. But this table is remembering not just the previous decision, but its consequences. And so when you backtrack, you have to unroll that too. Okay, and it's not all that hard. In fact, you can put it on a stack. If you have a stack-based programming language, you put it on a stack and you do a recursive call backup, stack changes. Right? That's the simplest thing that you can do. Yes?
What happens if the domain is infinite or continuous?
First of all, we are talking about discrete domain. If the domain is infinite, nothing changes. It's still basically, of course, there will still be infinitely large domains. There are, again, specialized techniques for infinite domains of certain types, which will work better than these ideas. Again, as I said, those are beyond the lecture that I'm going to discuss later. Okay. So with forward checking and most constrained variable and least constraining value, you are quite ahead of the game. You're actually being able to solve pretty large size problems. And then for project two, it looks kind of, if depending on the timing, one idea is to let you do something like Sudoku using CSP for project two. Okay, and then basically these are the ideas, and it's not particularly hard ideas. And you would realize that you can actually do them much faster that way than wasting your time trying to solve them yourself. Okay? So any questions on that stuff? In fact, CSPs are like, the interesting thing about them is they're very formally very simple looking problems. But there's a beautiful theory around them, because it turns out that you can, for example, we'll see some more, but the basic ideas are essentially very easy to understand, but there's also a large amount of depth to the problem that we'll see in a minute. Any questions on this stuff? Okay, so you should at least understand those three ideas, and then I will actually also talk to you about an entirely different class of solving CSP problems, a different class of algorithms for solving CSP problems called the local search algorithms. I'll get to that in a couple of slides. Okay, but then local search algorithms also make sense for non-CSP problems. In general, we talked about till now what's called systematic search. We'll talk about local search in a couple of slides. But before I get there, since we just talked about forward checking, it's actually worth talking about a very interesting point, which is what actually makes CSP problems hard? Why are CSP problems hard at all? Okay, it's all a bunch of variables and you just have to give them values and then there are constraints. And then you just have to make sure that the constraints are not violated. So if you think about it, what is it that makes a CSP problem hard? What it is this sentence. Essentially, what looks like a locally good assignment, which is the only thing you can do in search because you look at local neighborhood, what looks like a locally good assignment is actually globally dead. And because as long as that happens, then you will make assignments and you will have to backtrack. Now the three ideas that we discussed until now all try to handle this in some ways, right? By picking things that are going to die anyway, you know, first, you know, you can actually avoid some of the unnecessary search. And similarly, by looking at the consequences of the local decision on the future variables, you can do better. But generally, ultimately, the issue is, if you can somehow take a CSP, if you can wish for the nicest CSP in the world, you know, the nicest CSP in the world essentially have the property that what you do locally would also be consistent globally. In which case, you'll never have to backtrack. Okay? So then, what if you get a CSP, CSP1, you spend some time pre-processing that CSP to come up with a new CSP called CSP2, which has the following property, that every solution of CSP2 is also a solution of CSP1. That means in terms of the solutions, they are equivalent. Okay, they have the same solutions. Okay, but CSP2 somehow is more consistent. That means the decisions you make locally, you are less likely to have to undo them because of backtracking. If there is a way of doing this before the search starts, then in essence the new CSP would be easier to solve. Okay? And you can also, if you have such a pre-processing technique, then you can not only use it in the beginning to actually reduce the CSP into CSP1, but then at pretty much every once in a while during the search, okay, let's say you came up to here, you now have these variables have this value and there is a CSP on the remaining X4 to XN variables. I can try to pre-process that. Okay, and in fact, forward checking is actually doing something like that. Forward checking is doing the CSP for the remaining variables, and it's trying to make it locally consistent so that they are less likely to have to backtrack on them. But if you think in this way, you can actually think of a much more general way of increasing the consistency of a CSP. Okay, increasing the consistency of a CSP. Okay, and if here is actually a very interesting idea that I just threw it here, you know, which is that increasing a consistency of a CSP is sort of like the following. Suppose you have a huge big sink, you know, in the kitchen, and you're pouring water in the sink, and normally it's supposed to go towards the hole and go down. Okay, you guys haven't realized the design beauty of the sinks where actually water goes down. I have lived in places where the design was so bad that the water will come to the walls. Then you will realize what the heck were they thinking, and they did it. Okay? And what they did when they made a sink is essentially they changed the floor such that at any point the floor is gradient, local gradient of the floor is actually in the same direction as the global optimum for the water to be in. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so this is, if you got a bad sink, you could have one of two things. One is every day after you are done with your dishes, you take a huge big broom and try to push the water into the, you know, thing, right? Or you can just say, to heck with it, I'm going to get a bunch of cement and then change the floor such that it actually changes the elevation such that all the gradients are towards the one global place where the water is supposed to go. When you did that, you increase the local consistency of the sink. So that what the water is trying to do locally is also what it should be doing globally. Okay? And so in some sense, I pre-processed my sink so that it will work better. Okay? And you can do this for search spaces, first of all. You can also do this for CSP ideas. which is basically think in terms of a very nice notion called K-consistency. It's an abstract notion. It takes a little while to understand, but then a version of K-consistency for small k is 2-consistency, which for binary constraint satisfaction problems is called arc consistency, and forward checking is just a special case of arc consistency. This is why it's interesting for us. Okay, so you suddenly started from forward checking here, put a huge theory here such that forward checking is just a special case of one little thing. What that means now is you can spend your lifetime looking at the rest of the space if you want. Okay, that's the idea. So here is the idea. I want to define the notion of K-consistency. And this is, by the way, these are tricky definitions. You know, you might not get it today, but you know, you'll have to look at it again carefully. These are for all definitions. Okay? So a CSP, an n-variable CSP problem is said to be K-consistent. It's said to be K-consistent if every consistent assignment for K minus one of the n variables can always be extended to any kth variable. Okay, so for all k subsets of these n variables, for all legal assignments of these k variables, and for any k plus 1th variable you can pick from among the remaining variables, you should be able to extend this to include that variable. That's what K-consistency is. It's a pretty hard property to get, but if you get it, there's some nice things that will happen. Okay? So K-consistency really is, you know, basically we are saying, take any K subset of the N variables, find a compound correct assignment, legal assignment for those K variables, then you get to choose any K plus 1 variable, and you will be able to extend it to that. Okay? Now, what is interesting is that so K-consistency by itself is defined in terms of K-consistency is defined in terms of K minus 1 correct compound variable being extended to the kth variable. That's the definition. Okay. You also have another definition called strong K-consistency. A strong K-consistency means you are not only K-consistent, but you're also k minus 1, k minus 2, k minus 3, etc., all the way to 1 consistent. Now, this looks like a weird definition because it looks as if you are 4 consistent, you should also be 3 consistent. Turns out that's not true. Okay? In fact, in the homework, you'll see little small examples, very easy examples, where they will be consistent for 4 consistent, but may not be consistent for 3. Or they may be consistent for 3, but not for 2. So then you just go ahead and say strong K consistency is consistency all the way up to that K. Now, why is this interesting? If any CSP is strongly N consistent, if any CSP is strongly N consistent, that means 1 consistent, 2 consistent, 3 consistent, all the way to N consistent, then there is no search for that CSP. Because you pick the first variable, any first variable, give it any correct value, then any second variable you pick, you will be able to include it because it's 2 consistent. Any third variable you will pick, you will be able to include it with these 2 because it's 3 consistent. So there's no search. All you need is strong N consistency. So if I am given a CSP which doesn't have any good properties, I spend some time, get it strongly N consistent, then I can solve it in basically linear time. Clearly something has to give, right? Because CSP problems are NP complete, right? I can't do this too easily, because if I can do this in polynomial time, and then the rest of the thing is only linear, then suddenly I have shown that P equal to NP. So do you wake up again? It turns out the reason, while this is great conceptually, the reason it's a dumb idea in the worst case is to get kth level consistency, you need to do work that is order of n power k. So to get 2 consistency, you do n square work. To get 3 consistency, you get n cube work. Okay? To get n consistency, you do n power n work. N power n is just as bad, in fact, worse than 2 power n. But if it's a Boolean CSP, then the worst you will do is only 2 power n, and this is actually doing a lot more work. What does this crazy idea remind you of? We did this kind of thing just 2 classes back. Perfect heuristics. If you get perfect heuristic for a problem, solving the problem is linear time. But if in fact the perfect heuristic can be found in polynomial time, then the original problem must have been polynomial, because otherwise why would it be the case that getting perfect heuristic would be any easier than just finding one shortest path? So the strong n consistency is to CSP what perfect heuristic is to normal search problems. You saw this curve before. We'll use the same curve, call it differently now. Okay? Previously, this used to be H star, the perfect heuristic. This used to be H equal to 0. And then we would talk about the cost of computing the heuristic and the cost of doing search with it. Now, this is, instead of H equal to 0, this is K consistency with K equal to 0, 1, 2, strong K consistency with K equal to 0, 1, 2, etc. up to N. If you are strongly inconsistent, then basically there is no search. But to get strong inconsistency, you would have spent all your life to do that. So this is the time you spend to do the inconsistency enforcement. This is the time you spend doing the search after that enforcement of consistency. And the total time will be like this again. And again, the million-dollar question is, where is this minimum likely to be? Okay, one of the interesting things is, of course, it depends on the class of problems, but for a large classes of problems, n equal to 2 or 3 being pretty darned good places, which is good, because n equal to 2 is only n square amount of work. Okay, for most normal problem, n equal to 2 winds up being a pretty good place where the minimum occurs. Okay, and I mean, this is something that we only find out mostly by empirically. Okay, but for some other classes of problems, you need n equal to 3, which is path consistency, which is 3 consistency. Okay, so in fact, there is this whole notion of K consistency ideas. In defining K consistency, I don't care about whether the constraints are between only 2 variables or more than 2 variables. These are general definitions. They will work for any constraint satisfaction problem. But I did tell you that we are kind of biased towards binary constraint satisfaction problems because they have nice graph structure. You know, binary constraint satisfaction problems have a constraint graph which happens to be an actual graph. It's not a hypergraph anymore. So for binary constraint satisfaction problems, the 2 consistency is called arc consistency, because in essence, you are trying to make sure that any variables which are connected by an edge are consistent with each other. You can think of it as edge consistency too. Okay? And for the same binary CSP problems, a 3 consistency would be called path consistency. Okay, because you are essentially saying here is one variable which is connected to another variable which is connected to a third variable. Okay, so in essence, you are trying to make sure that you have an idea of the consistency of all 3 of the variables. Okay, so we will basically in the next slide, I will show you what it would mean to compute our consistency, to enforce our consistency on a problem. Okay, you already know basically that you should, for any variable that you pick and any correct assignment for that variable and any second variable you pick, you should be able to extend this assignment. That's what our consistency would be. Okay, here is a nice little example which will get you to see the power of our consistency. Okay, here there are just 3 variables, x, y, z. All of them can be taking arithmetic values 1, 2, or 3. So their actual domains are 1, 2, or 3. Okay? And it turns out I have the following constraints. X is less than y, y is less than z. Given these constraints, you kind of know, I mean, if you can understand arithmetic and you can understand inequalities, you know that really being extremely happy saying I have three possible values makes no sense because of these constraints. Really, each of them have there's only one way these constraints would be satisfied. X has to be 1, Y has to be 2, and Z has to be 3. And that would be a solution in that particular case. But in general, if I try to do arc consistency on this graph, this is actually a constraint graph here. This is X is a vertex, Y is a vertex, Z is a vertex. These are the constraints between the variables. Right? And so I'm trying to, now actually I'm going to try and enforce the two consistency, which for binary CSPs will be called arc consistency. Okay, it's basically an iterative procedure. You consider every pair of variables and make sure that any value for one will be consistent with another, with a value for the second one. Okay, if there is any value in anybody's domain for which somebody cannot take any values at all, then you remove that value. To understand this, I wrote this, you can read this at leisure, but let me show you actually what I'm going to do here. So I will start with this graph. I'll start with Z. Okay? I can ask myself, can Z take the value 1? It can't. Because if Z takes the value 1, then when I ask, can I take the value 1, then all I need to say is, if I take the value 1, are all my neighbors going to be happy with me? Neighbors in terms of arcs. If Z takes the value 1, its only neighbor is Y, and Y will never be happy, because if Z is 1, then Y is supposed to be less than 1, and there is no number in the domain less than 1, so Y basically says, I can't let you do that. So now Z realizes, I cannot take value 1 because my neighbor would be irrevocably unhappy. So as far as now Z is concerned, 1 is gone from its domain. Y is gone from its domain. 1 is gone from its domain. Okay. Now, can it take value 2? Yes, because Y will be happy with it. Can it take value 3? Yes, so Y will be happy with it. So at this point, Z basically just has 2 and 3. Now, I go to Y. Then I ask, can Y take the value 1? Okay. Now, Y's neighbors are X and Z. If Y takes the value 1, Z is okay, but X is unhappy. Since X will not be ever happy if Y takes the value 1, you have to remove 1 from Y. Now, since you remove Y from 1 from Y, you have to go back to Z, because Z basically previously thought Y has a possibility of taking 1. Since that is gone now, you have to ask Z, can you really take value 2? Do you understand what I'm saying? So there is basically an iterative procedure where you keep looking at an edge more than once, but only finite number of times. Okay? Until nothing changes anymore. So at this point, when you come back here, you will realize that since now Y only has 2 and 3, Z can't even take value 2, because if it takes value 2, this will be gone. So it removes 2. So now Z is actually only just 3. Okay, and if you continue this, then in essence you will get X equal to 1, Y equal to 2, Z equal to 3 after this kind of domain reduction. What you did here is almost similar to forward checking. You gave a potential value to a variable and you tried to remove what variables can, basically remove any value from a variable's domain which would be inconsistent with somebody else in the future. Except forward checking does it in just one iteration. Arc consistency keeps doing it until you reach a fixed point. So arc consistency is in some sense stronger in ensuring local consistency than forward checking is. Okay, so in fact in the project 2 for Sudoku, you would consider the difference between just using forward checking versus extra credit or normal credit itself, but just using forward checking versus using arc consistency instead of forward checking. You wind up spending a little more time, but you might get a better detection of failures down the line. Okay? And again, remember that while we thought of consistency enforcement ideas as a way of just pre-processing the problem, in essence, you could do it either just once in the beginning of the problem, or you could do it at any search node. Once you come up to here, you still have a small CSP left. You can try to enforce our consistency on that. So then, in fact, it's being used exactly like forward checking, except this is a more eager look ahead than forward checking is. Okay? So the point of the last three slides is forward checking really is about looking ahead, but it's kind of lazy look ahead. It doesn't look ahead that eagerly. And arc consistency does even more of that. And in fact, arc consistency is just the tip of the iceberg. You can talk about the general notions of K-consistency, which talk about how you can increase the local consistency. You can spend time increasing the local consistency. Increasing the local consistency, but you spend more and more time as you increase higher and higher degrees of local consistency. But the plus point is the search time will be reduced. And then normally two and path consistency, two consistency which is called arc consistency, and three consistency which is called path consistency are some of the best ideas where, you know, you get the best bang for the buck in terms of how much time you spend versus how much time you save. Okay? So we will stop with the CSP general idea, the systematic search ideas for CSP here, and I'm going to shift over to the notion of iterative search algorithms. Now, when I'm talking about iterative search algorithms, I could have talked about this separately once for general search and once again for CSP problems, but I'm just doing it once right now. And so some of this stuff also just works for normal general search. Okay? But then they're particularly useful for CSP algorithms, so we'll look at, you know, some of the examples with respect to the CSP examples. So the idea of iterative search actually came up multiple classes back by somebody's question, which was, do you really need to have the partial path? Why can't I just keep what is like a most complete solution? It's just not a solution. There are some problems with it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you could write, let's say, if you're trying to write a document, you can write the document by writing the first word, checking whether or not it's really, really good, and then writing the second word and checking whether it's really, really good, and so on, writing all the 5,000 words. Or just type away 5,000 words, look at it, and say, you know, if you're lazy, you can say, it looks good enough, let's submit it as a term paper. Okay? Or spend some time, change it. And then as the time is over, then you say, this is good enough for my term paper. You know, we can always whine later on if we don't get a good grade. Okay, that's iterative search. So you start with what looks like a complete solution, but it has problems. And then as you spend time correcting the English, correcting the grammar, making sense of the paragraph organization, you are doing local corrections to this big paper. But each correction to the paper isn't going to change the paper completely. Right, you'll just say, you know, most of the time when, you know, my kid writes term papers, and then when I ask him, you have to sit down away from the computer and read them and make corrections, and he'll sit down away from the computer, reads them, and makes just one correction, which is, you know, there should be a the here. And that's a really nice local search. You know, the rest of the 4,999 words haven't changed one bit. Do you understand what I'm saying? It may not necessarily make it an A+ thing, but it's like local neighborhood of this paper. The closer the local neighborhood is, the smaller amount of work that you need to do. Okay? These are iterative search algorithms. Now, iterative search algorithms make sense for certain problems, don't quite make sense for other problems. Okay? If you think of something like n-queens, it makes great sense. Because, you know, if you have an n-queens, which is n by n board, and you're supposed to put n-queens on them such that none of them will, none of them will be conflicting, right? You don't really care how you went from the board I gave to the board where they are not conflicting. I just want you to give me a version of the board that, in fact, doesn't have any conflict. But this idea doesn't at all work for Rubik's Cube. Imagine traveling the world with a solved Rubik's Cube. You know, at least when they sell it, they actually give it solved, right? Put it in your back pocket. And you go to your friend and say, okay, give me your initial state. And he'll give you the initial state. Then I put it in this pocket and remove this up and say, look, I'm done. Why is that not the same reason? Why is that not as reasonable as H-queen's problem? because in the later case they want to know, how did you do it? What are the steps you took to go from the initial state to the final state? In the former case, in the queen's problem, I don't really care which queen you put in which order. As long as there none of them are conflicting, you're done. Okay, now Rubik's Cube kind of problems also can be posed as iterative search problems, but if to do that, the solution itself should have the path inside it. Do you understand what I'm saying? The current solution should have the path inside it. Otherwise, it's not going to be, you cannot talk about it as a iterative search problem. So it's not as naturally written as a iterative search problem as something like finding the global minimum of a function, or something like finding a CSP solution, which is like an n-queens problem. Okay, so now if you do have, let's say, an iterative a problem which can be naturally formulated as iterative search, such as n-queens problem, what is the best idea I have for solving it? I'll do exactly what my kid does, or what you do when you come up with a random paper and try to improve its consistency. Right? You wrote something, looks good, but let me make this little bit of changes here and here. And then at some point of time, you run after your patients, and then, you're hoping that every little change you make, at least in your own warped sensibility, has improved the paper significantly. Right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have made that change. So in a way, what you're doing is you are climbing the hill of goodness of the paper. The paper that you had written originally is somewhat okay. Maybe it's worth a C+ grade. And you're making little changes, hoping to improve its grade worthiness. And for the various changes you're considering, you won't consider the changes that will make the problem worse. You'll only consider the changes that will make it better. Okay? And because you're lazy, you're only going to consider small changes, not big changes. You won't say, let me remove this entire chapter and write a new chapter. You're likely to say, let me put an extra article here. Let me, change this verb into a more, nifty sounding verb. Those are local changes. So, in essence, an hill climbing, essentially, all you need is, of course, a representation for the current state, which looks like a solution, except it has problems, and a function, something called a goodness function, which takes any current solution and gives it a number as to how good it is. Okay, the interest is to increase this grade, this number that this function gives you. The important thing about this function is it should be able to be applicable to both real solutions and those which actually are infeasible right now. So for example, it should also be able to take a paper which says for a particular paragraph, it's, you just wrote to yourself, put some stuff here so that the instructor won't get mad at me, right? It's not a paper. You are not going to submit it. Unless you want to really kill yourself, you won't submit a term paper where in the first page, the third paragraph is, put some stuff here so that instructor won't get mad at me. It's an infeasible paper, right? And yet, hill climbing function should still give it a value. If the rest of the paper is beautiful, then it should still say it's not zero. It is some value it has. Okay, it should be able to look at both infeasible and feasible solutions and give it a value. Okay, and further, the interest is, of course, to get a bigger and bigger value of this function. If you're thinking in terms of this function as the utility of the paper, you want to climb up. If you think of it as the cost of the paper, you want to climb down. So we normally think in terms of hill climbing, but you can also talk about canyoneering. It doesn't make a difference. Okay, and then the neighborhood function, which is what are the kinds of changes you are willing to make? What are the kinds of changes you're willing to make to the current solution? Okay, now by making changes to the current solution, so here is the issue, again using my paper terminology, paper metaphor, right? Here's your paper, right? And in fact, this is a paper that was just typed by a bunch of monkeys working on a typewriter. Okay, and here is Shakespeare's Hamlet. If you make sufficient changes to this, you can get here. And let's assume, for time being, that getting this would be really, really good. I'm sure some of you hate Shakespeare, but let's assume for now, we'll act as if we like him. Okay, we want to get there. If you make small changes, one word at a time, you are basically looking at small neighborhoods. If you allow all sorts of changes to this paper each time, then you're looking at a bigger and bigger neighborhood. Okay, the smaller the neighborhood, the easier it is to go to the next iteration. The larger the neighborhood, the easier it is to actually get to the optimum in few steps. Okay, so let's look at this in the context of let's look at these ideas. You know, so you need a neighborhood function, you need a goodness function, and let's look at it in the context of, let's say, 8 queens problem. Okay, what would happen in 8 queens problem? For now, 8 queens problem is really a CSP problem, you know that, but you know, let's not even think in terms of CSPs. Let's just think in terms of the problem specific features, such as the number of conflicts between queens. So given a board configuration with 4 queens on it, this is a four queen problem, your H function can be the number of pairwise conflicts between queens, number of pairwise conflicts. And what you're interested, so in this case, H is actually the cost function. And what you're doing is trying to make little changes such that H becomes smaller and smaller. In this particular case, you really want H equal to 0, which would be the actual solution. Okay? So, for example, this is H equal to 5, and just by making one local change, which is, suppose my neighborhood that I'm considering, is pick one queen and change its position. That's just a small change. It's like picking one word in the paper and changing it. Okay? A bigger change would be pick 2 queens and change their position to different places. An even bigger change would be pick 3 queens. The biggest change would be pick all 4 queens and find a better position. In which case the neighborhood essentially involves the entire search space. To make the neighborhood small, you will consider just pick a queen and find it a better position. Okay? So in this case, if I put this queen here, then the number of conflicts are only 2. Okay? Then I basically, let's say, pick this and put it here. Now the number of conflicts is 0. I'm done. And in doing this, what you would be doing in the hill climbing search is, when I pick this as the guy whose value I'm going to change, okay, I will consider putting it here, computing the number of conflicts. 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 Find the one version, the version for which the number of conflicts is the smallest. And pick that as your move, locally. So locally, this looks like a good move. And then you keep doing this. If your neighborhood that defines your locality is big enough, you luck out. If also the search space has certain characteristics such that what is locally good is also globally good, you again luck out. Okay? But if not, of course, this idea can get into trouble. It might reach a place where all local moves look worse than where you are. Now, is that really possible? Well, this is an 8-queen problem. Consider a configuration that you may have gone to. You know, you started with this, obviously there are lots and lots of conflicts, and you kept changing one queen at a time, and at some point you came to this configuration. This configuration is as good, it's pretty darn good. It actually has only one conflict, H equal to 1. Why? Those two guys don't like each other. Those of you who don't know chess, okay? Those two guys don't like each other, so you need to get them out of their ways. What is interesting is there is no single queen's move that will get you to a position that's any better than this. All the moves that you can make locally worsen the number of conflicts. I mean, that's what they say, right? It's going to get worse before it gets better. And that kind of stuff is no good if you're doing hill climbing. Okay, the hills that are easy to climb, if you don't have global positioning information, are cinder cones, because they have this nice leeway of doing it. Okay, the hills that are really hard to climb are things like Mount Whitney, which you can barely see, you know, and then in trying to go to Mount Whitney, you increase your height, and then falling down, and again increase and fall down before you get to Mount Whitney. It just happens to be globally the best place to be in terms of elevation. But locally, you would wind up, if you do locally optimal moves, you will never get to Mount Whitney. Of course, you can reach whatever you reach and say, this is Mount Whitney. And humans get to do that. Columbus wanted to get to India, and he get to the first place and called it India. There's nothing wrong. We can, you know, we change our world, right? So, but, you know, assuming that, you know, there is a test on this, and Columbus was going to be graded, he doesn't have that advantage, right? So in this particular case, you have a local minima. Hill climbing in general can get into all sorts of local minima. You can have beautiful names. If you are into mountaineering, you know, it makes a lot of sense for all of these. You know, here is a global maximum, here is a local maximum, here is a flat local maximum, here is a shoulder, and then you can even have ridges, where in essence what happens is the ridge is something where you know how the height is increasing, but there is no way you can increase your height by walking on the ridge. So you have to make lateral moves to get up the ridge. Do you understand what I'm saying? So local moves are not going to improve your elevation. And in all those cases, hill climbing isn't particularly useful. Okay? And then there is this whole issue of, you know, plateaus. Basically, if you are in the middle of India and you want to get on top of Mount Everest, which side are you supposed to go to? It turns out that India as a whole, as a country, is a pretty darn flat place. And then because of the whole of the Indian plate has pushed itself under the Asian plate, there is this Himalayas which are at the northern side. Now if you are in my town and I ask where am I going to, which side should I walk to get to top of Everest, it's, every side is equally bad or equally good. In those cases again, local moves aren't going to help you. Okay, so hill climbing can wander around forever, like supposedly Moses did, or and then finally reach the promised land, or may not reach the promised land at all, you know, because it got stuck in a local minimum. Okay, so now here is the interesting thing though. A hill climbing algorithm has certain thing which looks like a good idea, but which ultimately is its undoing. Okay, consider Moses versus hill climbing. Moses wandered around, apparently. I mean, I'm not particularly big on my Bible background, but you know, I believe that he was wandering around. He wasn't given proper GPS directions. Okay, he was doing random walk. And then hill climbers will actually have at least an altimeter and will try to see whether their elevation has increased or not. Who do you think are going to get on top of cinder cone fastest? The guys with the altimeters. Who do you think are asymptotically going to reach the top with non-zero probability for any kind of a problem? Not just cinder cones, also Mount Whitney's. Random walkers. Because if you keep on walking and never stop, even when, you know, you think you are in a good enough place, but let me walk again and see, even if it gets down, I'll again go up again a little later. Random walk is asymptotically complete. Hill climbing is not. Hill climbing is fast. Random walk is complete. Combine both of them. Then you get complete hill climbing. I mean, complete versions of hill climbing are smarter versions of random walk, whichever way you want to call it. And really, the ideas for improving hill climbing are exactly that, which is essentially, don't be so greedy. Okay? Add some notion of random walk into your neighborhood following. Okay? So the ideas for those include random restart hill climbing, which is the simplest idea. Which is you keep going for a while, you know, doing neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood. By the way, how much is the search space? I mean, how much is the memory requirement for a hill climbing algorithm? One. Wherever I am, that's it. I don't care how I got here. So, which also means I can keep coming here and be very surprised. Wow, this looks like a nice place. Wow, this looks like a nice place. And so you can keep going in a real nice, you know, cycling. So random restart says every once in a while, somehow go back to the starting position and start doing it again. In fact, not starting position. Go transport yourself to some random place in the search space and then start walking again. doing hill climbing again. Asymptotically, that's going to be complete. Okay? The other idea is a much smarter idea, is do the non-greedy thing with some probability greater than zero. So if you always do the greedy thing, then you, when you come here, you will say, I will never go anywhere because any other direction I'm going to go down. So if you have a non-zero probability that once in a while, so with probability p equal to, let's say, 0.9, you will pick the best local move. With 0.1, you pick one of them randomly, not necessarily the worst random move, but just one of them randomly. If that probability p equal to 1 of picking a random move, then it's just normal random walk. Since it's only 0.1, it means it's mostly greedy with a little amount of random walk thrown in. And that is actually a very smart idea, and non-greedy search with that idea will actually work wonders in most hill climbing algorithms. And then our last idea, which we'll again come back to next class, is actually to realize that this probability of doing the non-greedy thing, you want to change that probability as the search goes on. In the beginning, let the probability of doing the random thing be very high. But as time goes on, reduce that probability. And this idea is called simulated annealing. And the reason, you know, that's called simulated annealing is think of a plate which has a bunch of troughs, okay? And you have a whole bunch of marbles in this plate. And you want to do local shakes to this plate such that all the marbles will, when you stop shaking, all the marbles will get into the deepest trough. Okay? The smartest idea to do is shake very vigorously in the beginning so that everything is flying all over the place and then slowly reduce the shakes. Because in the beginning, you increase the probability that the things that are even in reasonable places will jump out. And so they are likely to fall into the bigger one. And as the time goes on, since the shake intensity is reducing, they are all going to be happily sitting in the deepest trough. This is not deterministically true, this is probabilistically true. And this is also called simulated annealing because if you want to make a perfect crystal, a glass crystal, what do? You take the glass and then you melt it, and then, you know, and put it in the shape, sort of shape that you want, and then you don't just go and push it into the deep freezer right away. You slowly reduce its temperature. Exactly that idea. These are three ideas for making hill climbing asymptotically optimal. When we come back next class, we'll look at what that means for constraint satisfaction problem. And then next, we will go into propositional logic, which is very close to constraint satisfaction. Okay.